Yosef Mekabolus Pnei Ashvina was his way of indicating that you see that a person has to forgo Kabol Pnei Ashvina under certain circumstances. All right? Okay. Perhaps one can suggest two halachic analogs for this position. The Torah in Hilchis Tzedakah cites for Besadi Goyim, who was quoted by the Ramon Shulchan Aruch, Chayiv Adam Lahakdim Parnasasa L'chol Adam, Ve'eina Chayiv Lesa Tzedakah Achi Elay Parnasasa Yishne O Shenema V'chay Yachicha Imach Chayach Yikoyim L'chay Yachicha. One is bound to obtain a livelihood before he's required to give charity, as it says, you and your brother should live. It says, your brother shall live with you, right? So it means with you that you have to be able to live first. Your life precedes that out of your brother. The Aruch HaShulchan explains that Rav Sadia Goyim was not advocating a position where one must achieve affluence before committing oneself to tzedakah. Rather, one has to realize a basic level of sustenance and then one's obligated to give tzedakah. Very, very fascinating. This halacha that you're not mukhiyah to give tzedakah until you're well off yourself, he says, it doesn't mean mamshi until you're affluent. It means as when you have the minimum that you could subsist, when you have the basics, then you can give tzedakah. Until you have to take care of yourself first. So he wants to say the same analogy in Ruchnis. Once you have the basics, then you give it all this. Just like you're not mukhiyah to give tzedakah when you don't have enough for yourself, right? But once you have a basic yourself, then you give tzedakah. So to Ruchnis wise. You're not going to give of your time ruchnis to others when you don't have enough for yourself. But once you have the basics for yourself, then you're mechuyev to what?
To give off to others.
Right. Okay.
Yep.
Right. The Mishnah Berurah quotes the Magen Avraham, which I think I mentioned to you. Halachos like this. If you have enough oil in your menorah to light, let's say on the fourth night, four candles. Your friend doesn't have, well, not your friend, somebody else though, doesn't have enough oil to even light one candle. So if you give some of your oil away, you won't be able to do the hiddur mitzvah of four candles. You'll be able to light two or three or one, right? But you won't be able to light four. So are you mechuyev to give up some of your candle oil? So now you will have to forego the hinder mitzvah of writing four candles so he can light one? Yeah? What's the halacha?
Yes.
Why?
Because you have the basics.
Because you have the basic mitzvah itself. Lighting one candle per night is the mitzvah. Lighting four for that night is the hinder, right? So you allow to give up, and you should give up your hinder for someone else's basic, but you have to have your basic. Nobody does say if you don't have enough oil for one for yourself, you give it to your friend. It doesn't say that, right? Now, by the way, that's interesting, Shiloh. Once you give away one for your friend, right? Now you have enough candles to light three. Do you light three on the fourth night, or do you light one on the fourth night?
One.
So how do you write only one?
You save them up so you can do it on a different
night. Right. Exactly. All right.
Famous story. Harav Yashir, in his biography of the Chofetz Chaim, writes, this is a very famous, I remember it was Yashir, that it was his want to visit his Rebbe annually on Rosh Hashanah. And when he assumed the rabbinical post, he wanted to leave his flock in Rosh Hashanah and bask in the ambiance of the Chofetz Chaim. The Chofetz Chaim responded to him that a human being was not only created to satisfy his own desires, but he has obligations of chesed to his fellow man as well. Top of the Gazak, what's going on? He wanted to daven by the Chofetz Chaim. He knew his daven in Rosh Hashanah would be much more powerful if he could daven with the Chofetz Chaim. So no, you have to be with your flock. That's your chiyuv. You may be giving up part of your davening for doing that. Echanami. A person was not created to live for himself. You were not created to be for yourself. Half of it. Right? Alright. So that's the upshot over here that Abraham had to deal with. Abraham did sacrifice some of his ruchnis, but Harai Hashem didn't speak to him all that time. But he said, since he had he certainly had more than the minimum, he had enough. Then he brings a great, there's a beautiful medrash, and I saw this in Reminiscent Alpert Sefer. Oh yeah, of course, Reminiscent Alpert, okay. There's a medrash Tanchuma at the beginning of the parasha, which I think Dafka didn't tell you then to say for now, but I'm not sure. On the pasuk of Lech Lecha, the medrash asks, are you allowed to walk when you're saying Shema? And then it says, while you're saying Shema, you have to stay in one place. But when you get to Hafta, when you get to Hafta, then you're allowed to start walking. And that's based on, and that's the word Lech Lecha. Lech Lecha. So the obvious kasha, what the heck does this medrash have anything to do with Lech Lecha? So this is Alper explains, beautiful pshat. Oh, this is Rebbe. Okay, the Rebbe is Rebbe. The medrash answers that, he asks, why did Hashem appear to Avram only now? Why did he appear to him all now? The medrash is trying to explain why Hashem appeared now. The medrash answers that until this point, Avram was preoccupied with the first pasuk of Shema. He was still in the process of assimilating the doctrine of Kabbalah's Omach Shemayim, accepting the yoke of heaven upon himself. Only after attaining and integrating the fundamental emunah is one permitted to walk and reach out to others. Alright? Like we say, Kshayit Atzmecha, V'achashayit, at first you take care of yourself, and then others. So that's the idea here as well, that's why Hashem spoke to Avram Lech Lecha now you can go and do V'at Hashem Lekecha, spread the name of Hashem, only because until now he's saying Shema. And when he's saying Shema, you have to stay put. You have to deal with yourself. Only later on can you walk around and help others. You hear that? So the Medrash is trying to explain why Hashem only spoke over here, because only now Avram is holding by the Madrega of saying V'hafta and walking around and saying V'hafta. Until now he's being Isaac in Shema, so he's staying stationary and taking care of himself. Beautiful, beautiful Yisoid, how he touched it up. That a person has to first, in fact, you know that even there, you always use example, right? When you're on a plane, what do they tell you? First, you got to give yourself the oxygen, then you give your kids, right? That's the Yisoid. You can't give your kids first. They always tell you, the mother has to put the oxygen mask on herself, then on the kids. Because what help does it help your kid, right? Right? That's what it is. Okay. Okay, so before one embarks on a Kiev expedition, and again, like I say, this is not just about Kiev. This is about dealing with anyone, you have friends. And it could be even in yeshiva, certainly not in yeshiva, that you feel maybe you're on a lower madriga, and they could be pulling you down. On the other hand, you feel you could be pulling them up. So the question is, are you mechuyev to help them or not help them? Right? Are you mechuyev to help them or not? So, look what he says. Before one embarks on a Kiruv expedition, one's personality has to be developed to the point where one will not be impacted negatively by every reef one confronts, or be buffeted by the winds of vagaries of kafut values that he encounters. Unfortunately, one often meets individuals who are sent to interact with a non-observant or non-religious peers. They have not amassed sufficient spiritual resources or nurture their intellectual and religious skills to effectively respond and impact positively on their cohorts. They have not reached a stage where their own rich bounty can overflow and spill over to others. In fact, their deed, therefore, is to continue to sign the first verse of Shema. Okay? Say it's a mistake. Some people go into the Kiruv field before they're really ready. They're not holding by that. The Rambam, in his presentation of the Odyssey of Avram, is careful to note that in the incoherent period where he was searching, probing, and groping, he did not dare confront or interact with others. It was a self-contained methodology where self-internalization was the avowed telos. At the moment he achieved a state of kivet shehikra v'yada, once he recognized and understood, then his battle charge became eminently clear and his sails are unfurled. Listen to the terminology of the Rambam at this phase. Hischela hashiv chuvas. V'la'arach din v'hischel l'amoy v'likwa b'kol godol lo'idiyam. In other words, the Rambam makes it very clear that Avraham Avinu, before he went out, he said we have to relook at this Rambam inside, because he doesn't quote the first part for whatever reason. But the first part of the Rambam, the Rambam says Avraham remained by himself, he worked it through himself, who was he, what's the moon all about, right? When Kiven Shehikr V'yoda, when he got to the state of Hikr V'yada, when he got to the state when he finally knew HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he felt he understood HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then and only then. And by the way, listen to the language. He began to wage a verbal battle. Because Erech Lami, it's a battle. It's mamash, when you go out there and you're dealing with others, it's a battle. And a battle, you can get wounded. You have to be very careful, you have to be fortified and well protected. One perceives and senses a decisiveness and a precision in every step. There is no waffling or equivocation. Okay. So, often, okay, now this is a comment on Kiruv, but I think it could apply here as well. Often Shabbatonim are designed to introduce the non-observant Jew to basic values and concepts of Judaism, are guided by individuals lacking the requisite expertise indispensable to its success. A Shabbaton must be constituted of individuals with a firm sense of purpose and direction who have grappled with the thorny ideological and philosophical issues that will be inevitably raised and have formulated proven approaches and methods to address those not yet problems. Otherwise, the intellectual confusion that will be engendered could be undermining his entire program. In other words, if you get somebody who doesn't really know, he doesn't have clarkeit in Yiddishkeit, and he starts answering questions, he can undermine the entire... The guy says, what? The guy has no idea what we're talking about. So a person has to be very clear before he's able to reach out to others. Let's see. Who's not? Okay, Sefer HaChinuch. Sefer HaChinuch. Sefer HaChinuch says the following. Shalai lishma min snabi b'shem avarizar min shosh mitzvah fi shatois nima nizav esal ben adam tamid. Why can't you listen to a false prophet? Why? He said the root of it is that people make errors in reasoning all the time. It's fascinating. Let's look at English. Not to listen to anyone prophesy the name of idolatry. Now, you say in your heart, I know the guy's an idiot. Don't listen. Why? At the root of the precept lies the reason that error is found amongst people constantly, and their intelligence is not clear enough to arrive at the ultimate truth. That's fascinating. Now, the Torah was apprehensive that perhaps, as a result of lying arguments and long discussion and debate with a false and speaking stranger who prophesies the name of an idol, a man might be persuaded by his words. And even if he's not persuaded, he may perhaps have some doubt in his heart, for one brief while, that there might be something of substance in the other's lies. And though we know that the other words cannot stand firm for more than some brief time, since the truth will show its way in the test about the prophet, however, the Torah has concern that we should not even lose one small while out all of our day in the uncertainty about that evil thought. But I'm saying an unbelievable thing. Said the human nature is, even if you feel you have convictions, if you listen to a guy long enough, he could shake you up. And therefore, a person should not spend time listening to somebody to idolatry. And even if at the end of the conversation, you'll agree with, you know what? I think it all through. Yeah, it's ridiculous. But you had that few moments where he shook you up, and those few moments or hours or days where you had lack of faith, that's also a problem. That's also lack of Kiddush Hashem. We know that from Makkos Becheiros. I don't know from Makkos Becheiros. Why does Hashem say, why does Moshe say, Kachatzos HaLayla, not Bachatzos HaLayla? Because he's afraid that, right, if the clock struck midnight, 12 o'clock, and people had the wrong clocks, and in their minds it was already 12:01, and the Makkos Becheiros didn't happen at 12 o'clock, they say, oh, you see, Hashem is not so all-powerful. That's right, so Hashem, therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu said, Kachatzos at about 12, right? To avoid a Chil Hashem. So everyone has the kasha. One second, Moshe Rabbeinu. Does that make sense? So let's say everyone starts dying at 12:01. Then people will say, oh, Hashem is not so powerful. No, they'll say, one second, I guess I got the clock, right? It's pretty amazing that at 12:01, everybody dies. Terence says that for that 1 minute, that there was that clarity that created a Chil Hashem. And it's not good for you either. So here also, the point is that he's saying a person should not enter and engage in debate with someone for the purpose of debate. There's no point of having debate. I think I told you the story. Sometimes we were so Solanter, I don't know who it was with, that there was a professor of theology that heard himself was a brilliant man. He said, I want to, you know, and he didn't believe he was not religious, but he was a professor of theology. And he said, so I want to debate you on Yiddishkeit. So Hassan said, no debates. He said, no debates? What, are you afraid? He said, no, I'm not afraid. He said, here's the rules of engagement. Life is too short for debates. This is the only way I'm masking debate. Either at the end of the debate, you're putting on tefillin because I'm right, or I'm taking off my tefillin because you're right. But we're not having a debate just to end it in a draw. In other words, Hassan said, the point of just entering into a dialogue just for the sake of debate doesn't help anybody. Life is too short for that. And besides, why should I create suffering? In my mind, there are other cases. I'm asking. If you prove I'm wrong, that's it. I'm taking up my tefillin. But I prove I'm right, you better put them on. I'm not having an academic debate. It's a brilliant point. And the professor backed off. I don't want those terms, right? Because it's also, if I'm right, there are going to be consequences for you. Don't just walk around and say, okay, fine, I hear your points. No. If I'm right, you got to do something about it. The professor didn't want that. So you're not really searching for MS. You just want a debate. You want to just create suffering. Not interested in that. You want to search for MS? I'm asking. And if I'm wrong, I'm taking off my tefillin. But if you're wrong, you better be putting them on. You know what's going on? So he's saying over here as well. So number one is, a person should not enter debate with the person who's a Jesus, Jesus guy. But even if you think you're right, don't enter debate with him. There's no point in enter debate with a Jesus guy. A guy knocked at my door a few years ago. It was on Shabbos. I opened the door, and it's two nice, clean-cut guys, actually wearing white shirts. But it took me a second to realize they're not Jewish, and I realized they're tall, blonde hair, blue eye, probably not Jewish. They were Mormons, right? And first of all, Mormons, they look for mezuzahs, because their best prize is Jews. They get more points for scoring a Jew than a guy. Jews, they can convert a Jew. They said, Jewish? Yeah. And actually, they saw my mailbox, you're a rabbi? Yeah. But we'd like to discuss you about, you know, Judy, about religion. Do you want to discuss it? I said, no. I had people sitting at my table, and they said, no, why not? I said, not interested. They said, well, no, let's discuss. I said, can I ask you a question? I said, sure. Can you read Hebrew? I said, no. I said, so you're going to tell me what it says in my Bible when you can't even recognize the original source? You're going to tell me what it says? Okay, we'll see. Bye-bye. And they left. I said, finished. End the conversation. They left. Sure, you're going to tell me. You're going to tell me what it says in my Bible. You keep reading the original source. Great, get out of here. But so I ended the debate. I wasn't interested in having a debate. I could have shmet them? Yeah, but there's no point in having a debate. Because it just creates something. Rabbi Rucham once said an incredible thing. Rabbi Rucham said, it's such an atif zach, it's unbelievable. I wish I had more smell like Rabbi Rucham's unbelievable stuff. He was a mashgiach in many places in Europe, and he had a tremendous way of looking at things. It says throughout the time in the Bnei Yisrael in the desert, they kept questioning Hashem, challenging Hashem. Or as the Chazal say, much says, testing Hashem. Why are they testing Hashem? Not because they didn't believe in Hashem. They said, you know what, we already came to the conclusion that Hashem, we should follow this, but let's go through the sukkah again. Let's ask over here, let's work it through again. And when we work it through again, we become even stronger. So that was a mistake, and that's why they failed. What does that mean? He said that, I think it was the Treaty of Versailles, when they already had made a pact, a treaty with all the allied nations and ex nations, Russia had suggested, I think it was Russia, Germany, Russia, I think it was Russia, let's reopen the pact and we'll redo it again, but let's do it again. And America's other said, no, we're not doing it again. What's pshat? Because once you open up a thing for review, you never know what's going to fly in and mess things up, right? I said in Yiddish, Eimol for Alamol. Once you make a decision, you stick with that decision. A guy gets married, and maybe he went through a bunch of questions, should I marry, should not I marry? He goes to a second size, I'm marrying her. You think you should be getting everyone going, let me review again why I'm married. Let me think it was a good thing. And if I come to the right conclusion, I'll love her even more. You don't do that, and you shouldn't do that, right? That would be the worst thing. Everything. Let me go through the sukkah again, why do I want to marry her? Oh, attack her, oh, Alamol. There are certain decisions in life. Once you make them, you stay with them. You don't open it up, because if you open it up, you create problems. So over here too, you don't open up dialogue and create problems. There's no need to. All right, I did promise we'll do a little bit of Azmir's.